The stress and uncertainty of the pandemic raised awareness of how important self-care and wellness are in so many aspects of life. However, it's easy to succumb to stress and worry, forgetting to take care of yourself. Society is in a chronic state of stress, but how can you find well-being?
It's really slowing down is the key to self-awareness and being gentle with ourselves to sort of see, feel, and sense what's really going on.
Find the St. Joseph's Health Medcast wherever you get your podcasts. St. Joseph's Health, a higher level of care.
Welcome back to Smarter Collaboration, the series that shows people of dissimilar skills coming together to create something new and breakthrough. Today, our hosts, Dr. Heidi Gardner and Ivan Matviak, meet Dean Butler, founder of LensCrafters. This is a company that was born out of a collaboration. We hope that you enjoy today's program and listen to how collaboration can lead to disrupting an entire industry. Here's Heidi, Ivan, and Dean.
Dean Butler is our guest today on Smarter Collaboration. Like Heidi and me, Dean's a fellow P&G alum. He's a visionary leader, founder of both LensCrafters and Vision for a Nation, a nonprofit which has helped more than 300 million people suffering from poor vision. Dean was featured in a book written by our executive producer, Rick Tocchini, When Core Values Are Strategic: How the Basic Values of P&G Transformed Leadership at Fortune 500 Companies.
So welcome, Dean. We're so pleased that you could join us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, guys.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So when you founded LensCrafters, you shook up what had been, in my words, a little bit of a stodgy industry. You caused a little bit of mischief and had a lot of success. And you did it by promising customers lenses or glasses in about an hour. And that was pretty revolutionary. What did it take in terms of collaboration? You had to bring together independent optometrists and the optical lab and a service team. Tell us about that.
Well, let me tell you how it all got started, because this is a serendipity story. I didn't go looking for this. It fell in my lap in a way. A friend of mine who is a district sales manager at Procter & Gamble inherited his wife's family optical business in Baton Rouge. And family pressures being what they were, all the family was employed in that business, and he went down there to run it, and he hated it. And he told me I should have never done this and all this sort of thing. And then I was talking to him one day, and he said, "Would you believe they're going to make it legal to start advertising? The Supreme Court's done this and that and the other thing." And he said, "And it's been legal next door in Texas to advertise. And these big commercial guys from Texas are going to come over here and clean my clock." I said, "Oh?" I said, "You just have to fight fire with fire." So having been in commercial production at Procter & Gamble, I said, how would you do this? Anyway, I came up with some ideas for him with his traditional optical business. And we took his sales in the face of Texas competition coming into Louisiana. We took his sales from $30-some thousand to $164,000 a month. And it was, wow. The one thing I learned at Procter & Gamble, this is the way I like to articulate, is how to market products in which there's no inherent interest.
What do you mean? People love washing powder.
Oh, yeah, and toilet tissue and toothpaste and dishwashing liquids and bar soaps and all that, right?
I got pretty passionate about Pantene back in the day. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, you do with the product that you're involved with, don't you? But
that's it.
You're lucky if very many consumers are passionate. And we figured out how to advertise and market eyeglasses. And I went to visit this guy one day and I said, "How do you make eyeglasses?" Answer, "I don't know. The wholesaler makes them." He says, "I got to go there today. If you've got time, go over with me and they'll show you how." So I went into this little workshop sort of place in Baton Rouge, and I was flabbergasted. The time to make a pair of glasses is generally 20 minutes. I said, "Well, people wait 2 weeks." "Well, yeah, This is just the way it's done. So I said, why don't you put the machines in the shop and make them on the spot? Oh, you couldn't do that. It's too expensive. Never be able to pay for them. I did some calculations and figured you'd have to sell 20-some pair a day. And that was when the best optical shops were doing 4 to 6 pair a day. Oh, I guess he's right. Unlikely to work. One day he phones me up and he says, can you meet me in Newark, New Jersey on Saturday? And I remember like yesterday saying, I don't know why I'd want to meet anybody in Newark, New Jersey on Saturday. But I went to Newark and there was a place on Route 4 in Paramus, New Jersey called iLab. And it was the first really big commercial optical shop in the United States. And they were doing a 48-hour service. And it was really neat. I liked what they were doing. And I said to my friend, I said, you know, they're missing an opportunity, though. They should be doing while-you-wait glasses. And he said, yeah, I don't know why they don't do while-you-wait. So that was the end of that. Several weeks later, he phones me up and he says, I've got my architect on the phone. And he said, if I build a while-you-wait store in Baton Rouge, will you help me? And I said, yeah, sure. But are you going to get back in the optical business? Because he, in the meantime, sold the traditional business. He said, well, I think this while-you-wait thing sounds good. Well, while-you-wait became glasses in about an hour. Because how
even
long
fancier.
Do you wait? Exactly. So I said, well, okay, it's your money. You know, I'll do it. And we did real people interview type commercials. And the very, very first day we were open, we did 21 pair of glasses, which was the break-even point. A few weeks later, on a Saturday, we did 100.
Wow.
That today is VisionWorks, which is one of the largest optical chains in the United States. So I was involved in getting that one started. And it did so well that after a couple months, I said, you know, I ought to do the same thing. And I said, you know, do you want to start doing this around? No. He says, you want to do Ohio, you can have Ohio. He says, I want Texas and Louisiana. He said, you can have the other 48 states. And he says, I'll help you get started. So we opened in Florence, Kentucky, in the mall. And, I mean, we immediately had a fantastic success. And the reason was we gave people a service that they couldn't believe. You know what we did? We put the lab, the machinery, in the window, not glasses. Everybody knows what glasses are. And if you get more than a couple of feet from them, they all look the same anyway, right? So we put all the lab in the window and we promised glasses in about an hour. And people would stand outside that window in the Florence Mall. And everybody was in the lab was in these white lab coats, right? And I'd stand out there acting like I had nothing to do with the business, just watching, listening to people. And they'd say, look at all those doctors in there. they were young people that we'd trained to run the machinery. But it worked. And what we then did was said, well, you know, we've really got a tiger by the tail. And before anybody copies us, we better figure out how to expand it. Mm. And after we were in the process of building our fourth store, we said, we got to get somebody involved that can put some money into this. So we got the United States Shoe Corporation involved because they were really big in the shopping malls. They had averaging 12 stores. Their big retail business in those days was Casual Corner. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And August Max and Jumpin' Jacks and Ups and Downs and all these different shoe and women's clothing businesses. So they bought the business and financed us. And I had a 5-year deal with them, a 5-year earnout. And Phil Barrick, who ran the business, ran U.S. Shoe, kept saying, Dean, you've got a black box. You've got a black box.
What did he mean by that?
A black box. It was magic.
Oh,
people kept just coming in. We were doing business like they couldn't believe. And U.S. Shoe had this process where you had to put in an appropriation request and real estate stuff and papers and everything. He says, just forget it. Just do what you want. And I said, I need people. And I had a deal with Phil Barrick that I could steal anyone from within the U.S. shoe empire if they agreed to come work with me. And we took a lot of the best people. That didn't make me a lot of friends in other parts of U.S. shoe, but that's how we expanded. We used their real estate people who knew all the mall operators and all that sort of thing. And within 4 years, we had the largest optical retail business in the world. It really wasn't rocket science. But what we had to do was to do things that nobody else had ever done before. For example, an optical shop in those days got their lenses and their frames from a local wholesaler. Well, because we were doing glasses in about an hour, we had to have the lenses and frames in the store, right? We had to have them right there. And you could get lenses. That wasn't a big deal. But frames, getting really good frames was a challenge because the big frame manufacturers would only make frames available through the wholesale labs. So the guy that owned Luxottica at the time, which is not a huge business back then, a guy named Leonardo DeVecchio, sent his son to come and see me. And he says, we're going to sell to you direct. So they were the first people to say, you know, there's something going on here. And then, of course, the other frame manufacturers started selling to us directly and so forth.
That's a massive change in the way that the retailer and I guess the optometrist is working with the manufacturer, right? That's an interesting sort of change in the way those two groups are collaborating together. Just paint a picture for us of who else needed to really work together to make all of this happen. So you obviously had the real estate business through the shoe company. You had the frame manufacturers. I'm guessing you had the optometrists in the store. Who were the other groups you had to coordinate and collaborate with to pull this off?
Well, it was the lenses and the frames were the big one, of course, and the optical machinery manufacturer. We quickly, by the way, went from the optical machinery manufacturer being skeptical of these soap guys going to sell eyeglasses to where we were their biggest customer.
Right.
That helped, right? Because it worked. But we really didn't have major problems with getting frames and lenses after people saw that what we were doing worked. I'll tell you where we had problems, and there are still problems in the United States, and that's with the optometric associations, because we were commercial. Commercial was naughty, and it still is to a lot of traditional private practitioners. It was deemed unethical to do marketing in those days.
Right.
There's no professions like that, so it's interesting.
Exactly. And there was a rule of thumb that said you shouldn't be within 3 miles of a competitor. Now, what I used to say to people in those days, here's a big point. What I said to people in those days, which is absolutely true, God comes down from heaven today and gives you $1 million, says you have to go open some shoe stores. And you know nothing about shoes, but you got to go do it and you got to start tomorrow. Where are you going to put the shoe stores? Everybody says, well, I'm going to go where the shoe stores are. Well, I said, optics is the same thing. It's a retail business. Oh, no, it's not. It's medical. This was a big one. I said, it ain't medical. I said, you guys have your own language. You have patients. I have customers. You dispense eyewear. I sell glasses. And the dynamics are the same in selling eyeglasses as they are in selling ladies' clothing or shoes or, and anything fashionable. People would not go into the optical store if they didn't think you could do the medical part correctly. They wouldn't get near you.
Sure.
And the state of Kentucky didn't like us at all, the Optometric Association. They had a regulation back then that says you're not allowed to put the doctor's name up in letters more than 4 inches high.
We just need glasses.
Yes, That was actually, and you had to have a separate door. You had to differentiate the practice from these horrible commercial people. So we had what was called a two-door situation back then. And then the other thing we had happened was we found we were doing 60-some percent of our business during the hours that a traditional optometrist was closed.
Mm.
Evenings, weekends, they're closed.
Times when it's convenient for the customer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wednesdays. Back then, they used to have Wednesday. They had took Wednesday off. Well, we couldn't get an optometrist to work on Sundays. No way. But we had a contract with the mall that would be open during mall hours. The mall was open. So, sort of behind the scenes, I said to the mall, look, I said, you got to help me. Write a letter to the optometrist and tell him he's in violation of his part of the arrangement. So I said to the, we had six optometrists. I said to the one, I said, look, whoever works on Sunday, you pocket all your money, all your fees. Within a few weeks, they're fighting over who worked on Sunday.
Right. Incentive theory in action right there.
Exactly. Dean, let me switch gears for a moment if we can. We read that you once said that too much information can paralyze collaboration. I thought it was a really interesting comment. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, maybe in your executive roles or as a board member. How does information overload impede collaboration?
You know, most of the businesses I've been involved in my career are not rocket science. They're pretty straightforward. And if you start getting everybody involved who thinks that they have a point to make and so forth, you just get bogged down. I'll give you an example from the old days at LensCrafters. We had people saying, in your TV commercials, you don't say you sell contact lenses. And I said, no, why am I going to waste time doing that? If I sell eyeglasses, I probably sell contact lenses. So that is a type of example of too much information. Then people said, you don't say you have eye doctors here. I said, no, but I got to believe that with the fact that we sell eyeglasses, that somehow or another we take care of that. So we always tried to make things really simple. I remember when one of my staff members came to me one day. Rick, are you guys old enough to remember dot matrix printers?
Yes.
Oh yeah. Unfortunately, yes.
This woman who was our buyer came in and she had this one of these stacks of the folded dot matrix stuff because I wanted to know what our best sellers were. And she comes in with this 24 pages. And I said, I only want to know what the best sellers were, just, you know, four or five. And then she says, well, I've got men's classification. I've got unisex. I've got women's. I've got children's. I've got metals. I've got plastics. I've got blah, 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 blah. And I thought, oh, my God. Too much information.
Right.
Just well, tell me what the top five selling frames are.
Yeah. It takes us back to our P&G days with the one page memo, right? It's like, you know,
yes.
There's only so much you can, you know, squeeze into one page. So absolutely.
Yeah. You know, it also reminds me, Heidi, of, you know, one of the parts of the book that we talk about, you know, a key element of smarter collaboration is getting the right people together, right, at the right time, right? And a little bit similar to what Dean's talking about with information overload, right? You can get participation overload
absolutely
as well.
Absolutely. I mean, we see it all the time where if somebody has one little role to play in a project, they come to every blinking meeting and they're sitting there bored out of their skull. They're disruptive because they're like on their phones or whatever. And you're thinking, you know, where's the leader in all of this to make the call that says, you know, we need you right now, but thanks and you're done.
Yeah.
Right? And so go ahead.
you're touching on a really, really important point. Let me get to that point by saying that I have been accused over the years of doing being an entrepreneur. And I said, no, I'm not. I've never, what do you mean you're not an entrepreneur? I'm not an entrepreneur. I'm a corporate guy. I happen to have done something entrepreneurial. And if I did it the way entrepreneurs did it, it would have never succeeded.
What do you mean by that?
Well, entrepreneurs find it extremely difficult to delegate. They find it difficult to put good people into an organization because they're the person that invented it. And they got to keep control. And they've got to, it's their baby. And I'm having that problem right now with a business I'm involved with, family business in Europe. And they cannot bring themselves to give good people authority to make decisions. And I'll tell you how I learned that lesson. In the optical retail business, 20% of your customers come back. That is awful. But I don't care how good you are.
You mean they come back with a problem?
Some kind of problem. One in five. And it ranges from it falling down my nose or hurts my ears. Those are easy, of course. To the one that is really funny. I can't see right. How do you fix that one? I could do 2 hours on just how to answer I can't see right.
Right.
But 20% of customers come back, and to them, they do have a problem. And I have always told our people, the one thing you've got to do is you've got to create enthusiastically satisfied customers all the time. And how do you do that? Find out what's going to make them enthusiastically satisfied and do it, and don't go to the boss and ask. Just do it. Right. If you have to give them a refund even, which is not what you want to do, and that's usually not solving their problem. It's usually not solving a problem for them at all because now they still don't have glasses. But what you do is you find out what is the problem. And I can tell you story after story about how that has worked. And there's one very good thing about having 20% of your customers come back. When you solve problems for customers, you're a hero.
Yeah.
The ones where everything was okay, just fine, they don't go out and do word of mouth advertising for you anywhere near to the extent that somebody who's had a problem and you solve the problem. And you do things like remake the lenses when you know that the problem was they don't like the lenses they chose or frames. I mean, I can't tell you how many people have come back and said they can't see right, and you look at the frame they're wearing versus what they used to wear, and you say, I can't figure it out. The doctor redid the eye exam for free and all these things. Everything seems okay, but I better know what the problem is. You change the shape of your frame so much that your peripheral vision has changed.
Now, okay.
That's BS, right? But it's, oh, maybe you're right. I said, what if you go back to a frame that's closer to what you used to wear? That usually solves a problem. Because what happened is the guy went to work and people said, look at you.
Right. Okay.
Too much of a cosmetic change.
Exactly. Yeah, so I'm really curious about this, Dean. When you have employees who feel empowered to do whatever it takes to make the customer happy, right? There's something going on in the culture there that they feel it's okay to take the risk. I mean, there's plenty of places that if, even the store manager gives a refund, they're afraid of getting beaten up, right? So how do you create that kind of culture where people really believe that taking what might be seen as a bit of a risky move to delight the customer is not just okay, but it's what it's expected?
If you empower people to make decisions in the customer's favor and they know you mean it, they almost always make the right decision. And I say that is true for an 18-year-old that's never worked anywhere in their life before. They usually make the right decision. If they do something really goofy, and that happens too, what I have always said, as I said, I want to thank you for doing what I've always suggested. You made that customer happy. Now, I would have done it a little differently myself.
Right. Still a teaching moment.
Still a teachable moment.
Yeah. Right. But it really works if you empower people and never come down on their heads if they have really tried to do what you want them to do.
Absolutely.
Makes sense.
Absolutely. Dean, I know you were involved in the founding of an amazing nonprofit, Vision for a Nation, which I think has evolved into One Site, which, and I believe it's provided, vision care for, over 300 million people. We'd love to hear about how that got started and the role that you've played in those nonprofit organizations since.
Well, those are actually different organizations. At LensCrafters, we finally got into the insurance type business because if you're not in that business, then people go wherever they have insurance. In fact, I tell you, it's funny. The way we solved the problem is when people started to walk, because they said, "Oh, well, you don't take my insurance." Is we told, "Oh no, we do. We'll take your insurance," and we would just eat the loss.
Wow.
Now, remember, the cost of eyeglasses is about 18% of revenue. So you can afford it. It's just like you can afford to make lenses over. Lenses are generally 8% of what the revenue of a pair of glasses. So you can throw a couple pairs of lenses away and so forth. But let me move on to the Vision for a Nation. There's a guy from China who was one of the most genuine philanthropic people in the whole world. And his name's James Chen. Wonderful, wonderful guy. And James has had a mission because he understands how simple it is to get people into the right pair of glasses. He's had a mission of correcting vision worldwide and runs into buzzsaws all the time. The big one you run into, can you believe, are the optometrists. To them, you're a threat when you do these things. We went to the World Bank, and the World Bank said, this is great. We want to fund this, but we're getting all this grief from the World Optometric Association and all this sort of thing, because they're saying that you might miss some kind of debilitating eye disease if you're not doing full optometric eye exams and so forth. And they said to us, can you show us that what you're doing really, really, really works? So James had the brilliant idea of saying, I know what we're going to do. Instead of going to 5 or 6 or 7 different nations, we're going to go to one. And we picked Rwanda. And we said, we're going to fix the vision problems of every single citizen in the nation of Rwanda. And we did. So that was Vision for a Nation. And that's one of the things that really worked. Rwanda likes to say that they have the only true 100% of the citizen healthcare in the world. And you pay, I think, $2 a year or something like that, equivalent for it. People pay a little bit of money. And the question is, well, how do you deliver, right? There were, at the time, only 10 optometrists in all of Rwanda. So we said, we want the legislature to allow us to go to Rwanda and not have to use these optometrists who think you have to do a 15-point eye exams, look for glaucoma and cataracts and on and on and on and on. So guess who we used? School teachers. Every village has a school teacher that is really respected.
Wow.
And we trained those people to do a basic eye test and dispense eyewear. And gosh, that worked. and we got the entire nation, literally, into eyewear. And I'll tell you, some of the videos and things, I wish you could see them. I mean, I remember one time a woman came over and she had tears in her eyes. And she says, I can cook for my family again.
Oh, amazing.
That's incredibly impactful. Yeah.
Yeah. And fisherman, you know, who said, I don't need to hire somebody to mend my nets.
Oh,
right.
Yeah. Makes total sense. Makes total sense. Talk about impact, right?
Yeah. One of the, Heidi and I have been involved with various nonprofits as well. And one of the challenges that organizations often run into is the coordination across multiple different entities. And certainly in a situation like you just described, where you've got the World Bank, you've got the government of Rwanda, you're trying to get school teachers organized, you've had, it, at least in some areas, pushback from the optometrist associations. How did Vision for a Nation, how did you organize the coordination and the collaboration across all those different groups?
What you have to do is you have to have one very high-level advocate. And in Rwanda, that was the health minister. He saw the potential in our program. And he said, okay, go for it.
And yeah, that leader at the top, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were empowered in Rwanda to do it our way, if you will, not to have to recruit optometrists and do what in the United Kingdom, where I live now, is called a statutory eye test. You just wanted, I tell you one of the interesting things about these sort of missions with optics. People know when they see right.
Right.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And you get the right glasses on somebody, and wow, that's it. You've done it.
That's fantastic. So, Dean, you had so much international experience, right? You started your Lens Crafters in the U.S. and you had multiple businesses in the U.K. and Australia. You have these experiences in Africa with the nonprofits. What are your observations about collaboration in different cultures? You know, Ivan and I have lived lots of places, you know, 4 different continents, I think, that we've lived and worked. And we've made some clear distinctions between what expectations of collaboration look like from one place to the next. But we'd love to hear what you've seen.
Well, while there are differences operationally from one culture to another, what I like to tell people is human beings are pretty much the same everywhere. They care about their family. They love their kids. They're helpful if you need help. I mean, every culture, everywhere I've ever been, there are some business cultures that can be, I'll call it challenging. I do a lot of business in Japan. Mm. And in Japan, you know that things are done on a consensus basis.
Mm.
And the first person to talk is the lowest ranking person in the Japanese organization. And it takes you a while to work through all that to get decisions made. But once you understand that, that's okay. You just work through it. But in general, it's all sort of the same thing. You find really good people. If you need official help, you've got to have an advocate for what you're doing, somebody that believes you're doing the right thing for the citizenry. And I've operated in all kinds of places where there are all kinds of strange things. And I found that very few people know this, but I have had one optical business adventure as opposed to venture. I founded what today is the number one optical retail business in Russia.
Oh.
It was the Soviet Union at the time. We had the first majority foreign-owned business ever chartered in the Soviet Union.
Wow. That, what year was that?
That was 1991 when we actually opened the first store. It was when Perestroika was going on, but it was still the Soviet Union. Sure. And we had an advocate. And the advocate was the guy who headed what's called Optika, with a K,
mm-hmm.
which was the Soviet lens and so forth manufacturing business, and he liked what we were doing, and we said, we will do this, but we want 51%. Ooh, nobody's ever done that. So here's the really strange thing. We got it through the system. We got it approved. And it was about 3 years later when I found out who approved it. A guy named Putin.
Putin. Oh,
he was the, everybody says, oh, he was a KGB agent. Yeah, come on. Putin was the guy in those days in St. Petersburg, Russia, who vetted foreign investment in the Soviet Union.
Oh, my goodness. That is quite a story. And you say you're not an entrepreneur.
And he's a lawyer, you know, by training. And that was what he did. And I didn't know it was him that signed the papers until later. I know Gorbachev signed the papers, but he was not the final decision maker. But we got it all done, and we just had a, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do kind of thing.
Right.
And we learned the lay of the land, but we were providing a service that people really appreciated. I've only had two stores in my life, anywhere in the world, out of 35 nations, where we had to hire security people to keep people out of the store. The first one was on Lomonosova Prospect in St. Petersburg, Russia, where when it was 30 below zero, we had queues hours long of people wanting to come into the store.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
It was, we were selling 1,500 pair of glasses a week, easily. And, I mean, think of a city the size of St. Petersburg, Russia, when you have the only Western quality, Western style optical store in the country. And the average salary in Russia in those days was $75 a month. And we were selling glasses for a couple of $100. And everybody says, oh, it'll never work there. You're going to flaunt these American products to people who don't have the money. Uh-uh. It worked. It worked very, very well.
Yeah, 50 years of pent-up demand there, I guess. That can help.
Well, in those days, you went into an optical shop and you knew your prescription, but only no astigmatism, just spherical powers, you know, like -2, -2.5. And you went in, you pushed a button that said 2.5, and a little light would light up, either yet or dot, yes or no. Those lenses are in stock or they're not in stock. And, I don't have mine. I got to come back next month. We had a huge success in Russia. One thing I got to say about Russia is it's a totally different place when you know the people than what Westerners would ever believe.
Yeah.
Some of the most wonderful people in the world. I'm not talking about the government. I'm talking about the real people. I love Russia.
That's true everywhere, isn't it?
I was going to say, that's true in so many places, right? You get to know the people and it changes your perception of the culture.
100%. I mean, I lived in Japan for a while. I was a Japanese major, undergrad. And
oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, I used to speak it reasonably well. I could read a newspaper. And these days, I'm lucky if I can order sushi in Japanese. And so many people say to me, don't you regret having spent that time learning Japanese if now you don't use it? And I say, absolutely not. I mean, it allowed me to live with families and make friends and understand the culture in ways that I could have never done. Mm. And it's exactly your point. Once you get in, you know, on the inside somewhere, the experience is completely different.
Totally.
You know, and bringing it back to collaboration, you know, we'd love to just wrap up by understanding what are some of the biggest lessons that you've learned. You know, you've had so many varied experiences, 35 countries, all these different kinds of businesses, commercial, you know, nonprofit. What would you say are the things that people need to know about making collaboration real and high impact?
Well, people have come to me all my career and said, oh, if I only had an idea like yours. And I've said, if you got a half an hour, we'll sit down and we'll have one. It's like when I was in college, I had a professor in my MBA program who'd made a lot of money. He's one of these guys who had a contract at Michigan State University, I think, for, you know, $1 a year or something like that, because he didn't need to be paid. He'd owned two different businesses throughout his life and did very, very well with them. One of them was he made manila folders. The other one was he made hammerheads.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, you know, I learned a lot from that guy, because he didn't do anything dramatic or anything that sounded innovative or anything like that. What he used to say is a little bit different than what we're talking about right now. It's not quite collaboration, but it borders on it heavily. He said, you only need to know three words: combine, eliminate, and simplify. But that fits with collaboration in that when you have people who understand these things, especially the simplify. We talked about simplify earlier. You know, I go back to frames. When that woman came in my office, and finally, it took me a while to find out what the top five selling frames were, right? When I found out what the top selling frames were, I said, well, what are the numbers for these frames? You know, those five frames were nearly 80% of our business.
Wow.
And none of them were fancy. They were basic frames. And when I started helping the U.S. Shoe Corporation and some of their other divisions, as I said, can you help us in some of the shoe businesses? Same kind of thing. I found out that in shoe shops, that in those days, 55% of the women who came in and said, okay, this is the one I want, walked away empty-handed because they didn't have their size or color. And when you took a close look at that, you found out the problem was simple inventory control. Sure. 80% of women's shoes sold in America are navy blue, brown, and black pumps. You don't ever dare run out of those.
Right. Makes complete sense. Yeah, I mean, and that simplification idea, it really does track with what we write about in research, because we call it smarter collaboration, right? Any collaboration might be bringing lots of people together, but Ivan talked about it earlier. The smarter piece is to really simplify it and bring in the right people only when you exactly need them. Mm-hmm. And that's when some of the real magic can happen. It's staying open-minded that at any point you might need somebody from a completely different realm, but in any given moment being hyper aware of how do you cut out what isn't necessary and make it as smart as possible.
Absolutely. Yep. Dean, this has been great. I mean, what an amazing career you've had. And we really appreciate you sharing some of the insights with us about the things that you've done, the people that that you've worked with, and how you've managed to use collaboration to really make a success out of these ventures. So thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you, Dean. We appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity. Anytime.
Great job. Okay, Dean, I'm going to change it from lasting impression to lasting impact.
Okay, that's better.
I love this interview. This was like being at a dinner party minus food on the plate.
Next time,
exactly.
Didn't have time for the food. No, but we can add some wine to sip while we're doing it.
Indeed.
Dean, we will, once we finish this show, I'll send you the link, and then feel free to share it with any colleagues or anybody else that's especially interested in advancing their collaborative skills. Okay.
Absolutely. And anytime you want to do any more of this sort of stuff, I enjoy doing this sort of thing, because at my age and with experience that I've had, I think it's one way that I really can be helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, people are going to be fascinated by this. I love that you were telling stories. Thank you for that. It wasn't just dry answers. You really illuminated it with the examples that you gave and the stories you told. So fascinating.
By the way, talking about Japan, did you know Amy Murray when you were in Japan?
No, I didn't.
She ran the P&G business in Japan a number of years ago.
Okay.
Which
You know what?
one?
When I joined P&G right out of university, my dream was to go to Japan with P&G. And then the longer I stayed, the further away that goal became. You know, it got harder and harder to move overseas with the company. And I ended up leaving and doing a Fulbright fellowship, and then living in Europe and all kinds of other places, South Africa and so forth. But
oh, wow,
you know, but yeah, we've had a great ride.
You know, when I was at P&G as the cheer, I was cheer brand manager. And
fabulous.
Cheer was the first P&G product introduced into Japan.
Huh?
So I was peripherally involved with that introduction. And wasn't it called Sinanso Cheer?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, it was a disaster. Have you ever heard the story? You know, Cheer has a substantive blue dye in it that makes yellowing things turn whiter. But Japanese women had a habit of dumping dry detergent onto the clothes in the washing machine, not into water. And so all the little schoolgirls' white uniforms had blue stains on.
Oh dear. Yeah.
That was a habits and practices thing is whoops.
Yeah.
Culture, right?
Gotta follow the instructions.
Yeah, I still do a lot of business in Japan, by the way. In you know where Okazaki is? Yeah, that one of the world's, in fact, I would say the world's best ophthalmic lens manufacturer is called Tokai, and they're in Okazaki.
All right.
Which is sort of down the road from Toyota.
I don't know if it was intentional, but I was smiling that we're all wearing glasses today. So
yeah, exactly.
We're all keeping with the theme.
By the way, that's another thing. We employed in the retail part of the business mostly young people who didn't need glasses. We used to put them all in glasses with non-prescription lenses. And whatever frame you put on nice-looking young women, you
I was going to say, those are your models, absolutely.
It didn't work with men, though. Whatever frame the men wore, it didn't matter. But with women... Other women would say, I like that one. What is that one?
Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant.
That's funny.
That's fabulous. Well, thank you again, Dean. I really appreciate your time. So after every conversation like this, Ivan and I put our heads together and we think about what are those key points that we want people to take away? What are the things that stuck with us? And so after that tremendous conversation with Dean Butler, here are a few of the things that we think are really worth remembering. First of all, when it comes to smarter collaboration, we are always talking about how bringing people together with unconventional backgrounds or very different perspectives can light a fire that would be hard to do if you've got just the same kind of mini-me's in a group. And what struck me is that Dean at one point called himself a soap guy. Right? What does a soap guy know about the eyewear industry? And you have, you know, somebody from P&G and the soap business coming in and shaking up this stodgy industry and being able to innovate and push it out of its comfort zone, take on the status quo. And I think it's just a brilliant example of why you need people who are outsiders sometimes and why you need to listen to people with the unconventional ideas.
And then he brought in the shoe guys, right,
yeah,
to help with the retail side of the business. So really interesting pairings. I was fascinated when he was talking about vision for a nation and how the philanthropist James Cham had really helped them focus their philanthropy, right? They had an original vision of going out and maybe trying to cover 200 countries. And they said, no, you know what? Let's really dive in, focus our efforts, find the partners that we need, and really make it happen in one country. In that case, it was Rwanda. And it sounds like they just had an incredible impact by really focusing and, again, bringing together the right people to make it happen.
Absolutely. What I love about that is it dovetails with what we do in our business with this idea of pilots, right? Mm. Go in, pick a small area to experiment in, make it really work, develop the proof of concept, and then you're able to roll it out further. So it's certainly hasn't been our idea our idea alone, but it was great to hear it happening there. And the other thing that struck me about the Rwanda example is that they really had a powerful champion. I think he said it was their health minister who was the champion who helped them break through barriers, overcome some resistance, do some really innovative things like train the school teachers in each village to do basic eye exams. And that's something that we also talk about a lot, Ivan, is that need to have that singular focus and somebody who's absolutely standing behind the idea, who can rally all of those other perspectives and make smarter collaboration happen.
You need to have that leadership from the top.
100%.
Right? Who is putting their support and credibility behind it, right? To really show to the rest of the organization that this is a priority.
Absolutely. And but then there's the balancing act, right? You have the person at the top with the vision, et cetera. But he made a clear case that if it stays, if the power and the decision-making and operations stay in the hands of that person, that you just don't get anywhere, right?
Right. And so the last point that I would raise is exactly that, right? Within the retail locations, they really focused on empowering the employees.
Yeah.
Right. They pushed authority down to the individual to really make decisions that were going to ultimately be right for the customer. That's not easy to do, right?
No.
A lot of leaders and organizations worry about delegating authority to that degree, but they used it. They believed it was going to create a better customer experience, but also used it as a teaching moment, right? He said, you know, obviously sometimes they won't do it perfectly or may not do it the way I would do it, Dean said. But, you know, in those cases, it didn't come down hard on people. He used it as a teaching moment and really helped people to use it to continue to improve.
Absolutely. I think that's brilliant. And that takes us to another topic that we focus on a lot, which is collaboration across layers of the hierarchy, across different status groups, being open to great ideas and initiative from anywhere in the organization just exemplifies smarter collaboration and that kind of leader. So thank you again for joining us today. We're delighted that all of you could be with us, especially with our special guest, Dean Butler, who is just living and breathing the example of smarter collaboration. So we hope to see you next time. And until then, remember, you can go fast on your own, but you can go further together.
Thanks for joining us on today's Smarter Collaboration. And thanks again to our special guest, Dean Butler, founder of LensCrafters. This show and series is produced by Success Made to Last Production in Austin, Texas. Executive producer is Rick Tokini. This show was co-written by Dr. Heidi Gardner, Ivan Matviak, Christine Dunn, and Rick Tokini. Post-production and sound design were led by Heather Barnes and Carla Tokini. And our series operations manager is Marie Ross. Until next time, remember, recognize ways to collaborate to enrich your life personally and professionally. Have a great week.